I invite you to open up your Bibles to James chapter 2, and we'll begin our lesson there this morning. James chapter 2. It's good to see each and every one of you here, and I want to talk, I hope, about some helpful things this morning. I do want to talk about justice and mercy, and I want to talk about them from the standpoint of what we find here in James 2 and verse 13, and obviously branch out from there as we look at what God's Word has to say about this topic, and particularly, we do want to learn about God's exercise of justice and mercy, but I think as James is talking about here, we want to understand that from the perspective of how we apply it to each other. That's certainly what's being spoken of here in this verse. In James 2:13, it says, "For judgment will be merciless to the one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment." So one of the things that we're going to do this morning that I think is necessary is to recognize there is some tension between justice and mercy. Because he's talking about them being somewhat at odds. Mercy triumphing over judgment. They're certainly not the same thing, we would say that. They're two very different things, judgment and mercy. And yet, at the same time, while we recognize a tension, we also want to recognize that God exercises both of these, and he exercises them perfectly, and so they can both be done and be held in balance. And so, it's not one to the rejection of the other. There is tension, but there's tension that can be held in balance, and we want to find that balance. We want to see what the scriptures give us to notice about that balance. Well, I want to begin by defining judgment and talk just a few moments about that. We're not going to give perhaps the most definitive definition of judgment, but I hope to give somewhat comprehensive as we look at the New Testament. Trevor has a very comprehensive article on judgment on his website, so you might talk to him about that. I will not get nearly so comprehensive. I would have put it in a bulletin, but it would have taken about three bulletins to fit it all in. But it goes through every single usage. We're not going to do that. But I do want to get some idea as to how that word is used, particularly as we look at the New Testament. And so to begin with, as we look at the idea of judgment, the word itself, by itself, with no other connotations, no context, it just means coming to a decision, coming to some sort of conclusion. You've got information, and so it can be something as simple, and the word can be used in this sort of simplicity in the New Testament, something as simple as you made a judgment, Nathan made a judgment to choose that tie, or Aaron perhaps made a judgment for Nathan to wear that tie this morning. And so that's not positive or negative. It's not any sort of rejection or anything. There's no negative connotation to it. Acts chapter 27, we see that sort of usage of the word judgment. Acts chapter 27, and there's these other places in Acts. In fact, this word is used throughout the book of Acts. But Acts 27 in verse 1, it says, "When it was decided that we would sail for Italy, they proceeded to deliver Paul and some of the other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius." Now, that word "decided" right there at the beginning of the verse is the word "judgment." It's the same word in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 1, "judge not that you be not judged." The same word in James chapter 2 and verse 13, "judgment will be without mercy." And so here, all he's talking about, we decided to go to Italy. You see, there's no extra connotations to that word, just we made a decision. We came to a conclusion. Over in Romans chapter 14, you can see that judgment can go either direction. And so judgment certainly is not always the negative side, but judgment is just a decision, positive or negative, yes or no. In Romans chapter 14 and in verse 5, in fact, this word again is used throughout this chapter. We're talking about a lot of judgment matters in Romans 14. But verse 5, it says, "One person regards," there's our word "judge." In fact, some of your translations may say "judges." The footnote in the New American Standard does. "One person regards or judges one day above another. Another regards or judges every day alike. Each person must be fully convinced in his own mind." And so here, you see, people are judging both ways. I judge that this is more important. I judge that this is less important. I judge that we should eat meat. I judge that I'll eat no meat. And so those are the sorts of judgments that are being made. Neither positive nor negative, just taking information and making a decision. Sorts of judgments we make every day. And let me just say, this sort of mundane usage, this sort of reasoning ability, taking information and making decisions, I tell you what, if we cast off this judgment, Well, that's very much what we find in society today, right? People who want to draw no conclusions about anything. It just, you know, I can't say one way or the other. I mentioned a while back where a fellow was going onto a college campus and he said, what if I told you that I was a woman? They could not make a judgment on that. They said, it's just not for me to say. And he said, well, what if I told you I was Chinese? Well, it's just, I can't make a decision on that. Can't make a judgment. And he said, what if I told you I was 7 foot tall? And he said, well, you're not. And he goes, you're getting close. But see, even there he goes, but if you feel that way, then I can't make a judgment. You see, it's all rationality thrown out. And so that's, in its essence, judgment is just you using your rational mind, taking information and making a decision about that. That's what Jesus wants the Pharisees. He wants those who follow after and are looking and making judgments. He wants them to make judgments with good information. In Luke chapter 12 and in verse 57, he says, why do you not even on your own initiative judge what is right? And so he wants them to take the information that they see and make good decisions. He would say with regards to himself, he says, you look at the weather and you make judgment calls about that. And you got the same sorts of information about me. And so you could make good judgments about me. He wants us to use those skills. In fact, we need to be willing to use those skills even in making very important decisions of perhaps disagreements between brethren. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, he says there, I say this to your shame. Is it so that there is not among you one wise man who will be able to decide, that's a word judge or judgment there, be able to judge between his brethren? And so the idea is, don't go to the judge at the courthouse. Don't go to the man who doesn't even believe in God and ask him to make a decision for you. Find a godly man with some wisdom in the church. And if you've got a disagreement, isn't there somebody you could take that to who believes in God who could help you come to a decision on that? And so he wants us to be using that kind of reasoning, that kind of judgment. He wants us to be drawing conclusions. But of course, as we look through the New Testament, there are these passages that speak to that word in a negative way. The context lets us know that it's not just saying one's as good as another, but that we're making a judgment, and that judgment is condemnation. In John chapter 3 and verse 16, of course, is the passage of that is so popular in the world, that God gave his only begotten Son. Whoever believes on him shall not perish, but have eternal life. He goes on to say, verse 17, for God did not send the Son into the world to judge the world. Now that right there seems off, it seems in and of itself, he's saying that in a negative way. And I think we could supply the word condemn there. It's the same word as these other places, but here it clearly seems to point to condemnation. So he did not send him to judge the world, but that the world might be saved through him. And then further in verse 18, he who believes in him is not judged. Now he is judged. He's judged righteously. But here he's not judged in the sense that he's not condemned. He who does not believe has been judged already because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son. So it's the non-believer who's judged. It's the one who does believe who is not judged. The non-believer is condemned. The one who believes is not condemned. Acts chapter 13 and verse 27, Paul uses this word, the English translators in the New American Standard have translated that condemned. He's talking about Jesus there, and he's talking about those who condemned Jesus. They condemned him to death. So he stood before men, and they judged him. And judgment in that case automatically means a bad thing. It automatically means you're going to die. We might term it like this. It automatically means, or can mean, I think you're going to hell. So that's the judgment that's being talked about in several cases. Along with this, along with that idea of condemnation, there's this idea of authority, so that my judgment carries weight. It's the final word. It's the final say-so. Over in 1 Peter chapter 4, and there in verse 5, It says, but they will give an account to him, that is, of course, the Lord. They will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. He is the judge, right? And that's what James says. Back over in James chapter 4 and verse 12, he speaks of God in this way. James chapter 4 and verse 12. But above all, there is only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and destroy. But who are you to judge your neighbor? And so I think as we look at this, there's a point as we talk about judgment and mercy, and we talk about how we use judgment, how we shouldn't judge and so forth, there needs to be a recognition of our position. What sort of a position are we in? Somebody says, are you judging me? Well, if you mean that I'm condemning you to hell, well, no, I'm not the one who makes that call. I'm not the final authority. And in fact, very often, there needs to be a recognition that I have no need to make a judgment. Sometimes I do. Maybe I'm a parent. And so I look at my children and I make judgment calls about what they're doing. I decide whether or not that's something I approve of or not. But then somebody who's not my child is over here doing this. Say it's the amount of candy that they eat. I get to decide that with my children. You see, I'm an authority. And I get to draw those conclusions. And I get to say, that's enough. And they say, well, why? Who are you? Well, I'm your parent. So I get to decide that. But then I see another child over here who's not mine, and he's eating more candy than I want my children to eat. Well, I'm not his parent. And so my kids might come up and say, hey, he's eating more candy than I am. I know, I'm not his parent. I am yours. So you see, there's certain scenarios where I've got authority, I've got business in coming in and making a judgment call. And then there's some other scenarios where I just have no business making those judgment calls. Of course, God has the business of making all the judgment calls. He's the one at the end of it all who gets to decide about what everybody's doing. But sometimes I think we could help ourselves so much if we just say, you know, I really don't have to worry about that. I'm not responsible for that person. I'm not responsible for what they're doing. In fact, you know, when we look at 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and there's this discussion about what to do about this brother, and somebody, Paul suggests that somebody will say, well, what about the outsiders? And Paul says, what have I got to do with them? I've got nothing to do with them. That's not my responsibility. I have some responsibility with you guys though. And so he exercises that responsibility with them. And so we want to be careful to recognize our position, recognize we're not the police officers of the world, and we're not even the police officers necessarily, of even all the people around us. Elders have more responsibility, parents have more responsibility. But our responsibility is not the same as God's, none of us. And we also are limited as far as what judgments we can make about condemnation. I'll talk more about that in just a moment. Well, I think a lot of this also has to do with what information we have available to us. It's not just that we have the authority to make a judgment. Sometimes we do have authority to make a judgment. Sometimes our judgment is simply that we're preaching the word of God. But sometimes we make judgments without all the information. And it's not even a matter of being able to get all the information. Sometimes all the information is not even available to us. We just can't know certain things. We'll talk about that in just a moment. I do recognize that sometimes there is enough information. One of the things Paul says is he's writing there in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and in verse 3 is he's writing about this man who is in the midst of an adulteress, and not just an adulteress, but a particularly heinous adulterous situation with his father's wife. Paul says with regards to that, for I on my part, though absent in body but present in spirit, have already judged him who has so committed this as though I were present. Sometimes, you know, with regards to situations, somebody make a judgment and somebody will say, well, you weren't there. And you might say, depending on the scenario, can you tell me what information would make this action okay? You know, there's no circumstance under which it's all right for this to be going on. But you just don't understand. There may be things I don't understand, but I don't have to understand anything else to know this is not okay. So you see, sometimes we don't need more information. And I think sometimes that's kind of a cop-out. It's sort of an excuse when we talk about coming to conclusions. People say, well, you just never can know. Well, there are some things you can know. And Paul seems to indicate that here. Additionally, in chapter 6 and verse 5 that we already looked at, we're finding this man. We're looking for someone who's willing to help us come to a conclusion about a disagreement. I'll illustrate it like this. When we have our Bible study, a profitable for teaching Bible study, men's study every fall, we have these men, these older preachers and teachers, and they come and they sit on a panel and we ask them questions. And inevitably, these guys will ask them questions. We'll say, what would you do? What are your thoughts? What's your practice about this? And they'll say, well, it's a judgment call. And finally, this year I said, we know. We want what your judgment is. That's what we're asking for. And even then, they were hesitant. They knew that it wasn't their place to tell us, you know, definitively what we have to do. And we said, we get that. But we're asking you to take into account those things and then give us your advice. Give us your judgment on this. Give us what conclusions you've come to in your life. And so sometimes we might go to somebody and they say, well, I'm just not willing to sort of make a decision there. But we're asking you for help. And when somebody comes and asks you for help, look for the information. Try to find out as much as you can and then try to help come to a decision if that's possible. But too often, there are many, many of us who will go into making a decision, willing to draw conclusions with information that we can't get and that we can't know. Over in 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and beginning in verse 4, Paul says, for I am conscious of nothing against myself. Excuse me. Let's back up to verse 3. But to me it is a very small thing that I may be examined by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even examine myself, for I am conscious of nothing against myself, yet I am not by this acquitted. But the one who examines me is the Lord. Therefore, do not go on passing judgment before the time, but wait until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the things hidden in the darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts, then each man's praise will come to him from God. Sometimes we look at a scenario and whether or not that person is wrong or doing something wrong has a great deal to do with what's in here. It's not just about the act itself, but it's about the motive behind the act. It's certainly the case with a wrongful death, isn't it? So let's say that there's an accidental death. Well, if we find out that the person who caused that death actually intended to cause that, well, now we got a whole different ballgame, don't we? But we have to be able to prove that in a court of law. You've got to be able to prove that with intent, they went about, set about, planning and purposefully taking that person's life. Let's say we're out hunting together and a gun goes off by accident. We don't call that murder. We call it a tragedy. We call it a terrible accident. And that person is probably going to feel a great deal of remorse. But we don't make a judgment. And we don't put that person in jail. And we don't say that person's a terrible person even. There are things that we can't know. And so we look for evidence. And if we can come up with evidence that shows the intent of the heart, that person has exposed what's in their heart, then that's all well and good. But if it's a situation where you're seeing someone and they're behaving in a certain way, and they, as far as their own defense, give testimony that suggests their intent is not evil, then that's where we're left. Somebody says, well, I'm just not sure about that. We're just not going to be. You can't know what's in a person's heart unless they reveal it to you in some way. And so that's got to be exposed. God knows, and that's what Paul says here. God knows. And what's happening here is they're accusing Paul of things, and Paul says, that's not what's in my heart. That's not the way I'm approaching you. And he's defending himself, and he says, but honestly, you all don't know what's in my heart. And to some degree, it may even be hidden from me, but God knows. And we'll all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. And so we've got to be willing to admit when there are things that we just can't know. And we can't act on what our suspicion is of what somebody's thinking. Unless we have evidence, unless we have some foundation on which to make a judgment. Now I know there are sins that it doesn't matter what the motivation is. Back to chapter 5 and verse 3. It doesn't matter what the motivation of this young man with his father's wife is. You see, I don't have to take that into account to know that sin. But there are other things where motivation is required. You know, and so we need to take that into account. And when that's the case, we need to judge with mercy. I'll give you an example. Let's say somebody walks out of a store with something in their pocket. Now, I know, obviously, the first conclusion is that they just stole that. They didn't pay for it. It was in their pocket and they walked out of the store. Is it possible that as they were looking, they ran out of place to put things and they didn't have their buggy, and so they put something in their pocket and forgot to take that out and put it on the cash register? Yeah, that's very possible. And so in a scenario where we see a Christian, perhaps, in a situation like that, and we don't know what they intended to do there, can we give benefit of the doubt? Yeah, I think we can. And I think we can assume the best. And when a husband says something to his wife and the wife takes that as hurtful and she says, oh boy, I tell you, he was really trying to run me down there. And she brings that up to him and says, no, I didn't mean that at all. Can you give him the benefit of the doubt? Can you judge with mercy? And the mercy is not, you did something terrible, but I'm going to overlook it. The mercy is, I'm not going to believe you did something terrible unless I have evidence to support that. That's where the mercy is. It's not supplying information that you don't have. And so that's where we want to be careful. We don't know enough to have all the answers sometimes because of the particulars of a situation. God's word is applied specifically and differently in certain scenarios. Over in James chapter 4, in James chapter 4 and verse 11, and I think this is to the point of what James is saying as far as becoming judges of the law. In James chapter 4 and in verse 11 it says, do not speak against one another, brethren. He who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge of it. There is only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you who judge your neighbor? I think this speaks to those sorts of things that are mentioned over in Romans chapter 14. In Romans chapter 14, where we have a situation where there might be somebody who certainly looks at meat and says, listen, have you ever heard somebody say, I just don't see how a Christian could do that? They're not willing to fully say, yes, that's sin. They're not willing to say, absolutely, that's wrong. They just say, I would be so uncomfortable doing that. And to the person who can't eat meat in Romans chapter 14, let me just say, I'm sympathetic with the fact that he can't do that. I get that. But I also see how a Christian could do that. I see how a Christian who didn't grow up like he did and who doesn't have that association with meat that causes the guilty conscience goes right along and eats whatever he likes because God has made it all clean for us. And so he's got a clear conscience, and that's what Paul talks about in Romans chapter 14. But somebody comes along, and because he himself is uncomfortable. You know, I know brethren who are uncomfortable to see women wearing pants, not just in the assembly, but anywhere. And I know brethren who are uncomfortable seeing women pants in the assembly. And I understand that. And I've had a talk with my girls to say, look, this is my judgment. It's my judgment. I don't preach that as the ultimate judgment, but it is mine. And again, I'm their parent, so I get to make that decision, right? And so I say, you're not going to wear pants to church. But if somebody else does that, I understand why it makes me uncomfortable. I understand why it doesn't make them uncomfortable. And so I'm not the one who gets to come in and say, I'm the lawgiver. Unless I can hold this up and say, the lawgiver said, then I don't get to make the judgment. I leave that with God. Now, where we can say the lawgiver said, that's a whole different matter. But unless we can get up and say the lawgiver said, then we've got to back off and we've got to leave room for people to come to different conclusions. Even where the lawgiver has said, over in Matthew chapter 12, where the disciples are going through the fields and they're plucking the heads of grain, the lawgiver did say that you shall not work on the Sabbath. But they had decided, they had gone beyond what the law said, and they had decided that plucking the heads of grain was harvesting grain. You see, they became lawgivers. They went a step beyond what the law said. In fact, the law makes provision for the very thing of plucking heads of grain. And so they had set themselves up as the lawgivers. Matthew chapter 15 would say they set their traditions above the law of God. And he says, you don't have a right to do that. And so sometimes, with regards to those kinds of situations, maybe somebody comes to us and asks us. I was having a conversation with Paul Loggins a couple of weeks ago. And so here's an answer to some of that. And we were just talking about certain situations, about where you buy things, where you buy food. You know, people are having fundraisers, they're going to have a barbecue dinner. Can you go and just buy a plate? And, you know, is there anything wrong with that? And I see some difficulties there that we have to kind of work through. And one of the things that I told him is where it says, you know, eat whatever sold in the marketplace and don't ask any questions. I said, you know, when I was growing up, they used to go around and sell Krispy Kreme donuts on Saturday mornings, you know, the various organizations. And inevitably, you open the door and they'd say, would you buy some Krispy Kreme donuts? We're trying to raise money for. And then they would say what they're trying to raise money for. And, you know, about half the time, it was something I just really couldn't contribute to. So I got to where I'd open the door and I'd see somebody standing there with a box of Krispy Kreme donuts. She says, would you like to buy a box of Krispy Kreme donuts? I'm trying to raise money for it. I'd say, stop. Just take my money. I'll take the donuts. What you use that money for is your business. Just want the donuts. Now that's what I do business out in the world. Somebody comes up and says, hey, do you know what that company does with that money? You know, that's not my business. I just wanted some food. And so I went and I bought some food from them. And somebody might have a problem with that. Somebody might not like my stance on that. Okay. But you're not the lawgiver. And neither am I. And so we're gonna work through those things. We're gonna talk about what's best. And then we're gonna leave some room for people to draw their own conclusions. People don't like that. They want yes or no answers. They want to be told this is what you ought to do. This is what you ought not to do. And there's just some areas where God says it's just not that easy. And so he's going to give us principles. He's going to give us wisdom to live by. And then we've got to make some personal conclusions. But I also think, and here this is very important, sometimes we are blind to information, not because we can't obtain it and not because of some difficulty of the matter, like in Romans 14, but just because we don't like the person. And that's a problem in Romans 14. It's not just that we look at that brother and we're worried about the, you know, that this is, it's a completely a doctrinal matter. It's, we don't like this person to begin with. And so he says here in Romans 14 and verse 3, the one who eats is not to regard with contempt the one who does not eat. And the one who does not eat is not to judge the one who eats, for God has accepted him. Again, down in verse 10, it repeats the refrain there, but you, he says, why do you judge your brother? Or you again, why do you regard your brother with contempt? For we will all stand before the judgment seat of God. So I think sometimes what happens is we look out, and if this was somebody really close to us, and I mean, it plays out all the time. You can take the very same behavior, the very same activity, and you let somebody I like do that. And I'm going to say, well, you know, there's a number of things to consider. And we want to think about this from a lot of different angles. But you make it somebody we don't like and you say, well, that's just how they are. And you just throw it out immediately. You don't give any consideration. You don't say, well, maybe there's more to the story. You just say, well, I know how they are. And you immediately sign ill motives and whatever else. And so there's more to this than just maybe you don't know all the story. Maybe you don't want to know all the story. And so here's the idea of you need to want to. You need to want to love that brother and see that brother as someone for whom Christ died. And along those lines, it's not just being honest about whether or not we have contempt for them, but being honest is with ourselves about, is this how we want ourselves to be viewed? Back over Matthew chapter 7, that's what that's talking about. Matthew chapter 7 and verse 1 beginning, judge not that you be not judged. And then he talks about this plank or this beam in the eye of the one who's doing the judging and the speck in the eye of the one who is being judged. And the idea is that we're so blind when we put our inspector glasses on for everybody else and we have no inspector glasses for ourselves. Oh, how many times, how much more emphatic could the New Testament possibly be and say, look at yourself first. Take an honest assessment here. And so, we have those conversations. That's the kind of conversation about showing mercy in general. I was having a conversation with a fellow the other day, and he just really lost his temper with somebody. They'd made a mistake. It cost him some money. And he went off on them. And I said, why did you do that? And he said, well, they cost me. Well, this particular fella has made some mistakes that have cost me some money. And I said, do you know how much money you've cost me? And he said, what's that got to do with anything? I said, well, do you want me to talk to you like you talk to them? And of course he doesn't. But he's blind. And he doesn't want to look here. And he looks everywhere else but here. And I'm going to tell you what, those are the hardest judges in the world. And they're the ones who will be judged most unmercifully, going back to James chapter 2. The people who cannot see here, who forgive every indiscretion and every mistake they make, they think nothing more of it, they move right along, but you let somebody, forget to shake their hand one day. And they just add it to the tally. Oh, it's just another thing on the list. It's just how people are. That's how you are. But it's not necessarily how they are. And so we need to be careful to recognize, what do we know? We may not know as much as we think we do. And if we don't have the information, then don't supply the worst possible scenario into that. One more thing about that. And then I think I'm going to have to hold some of this to another occasion. Or maybe we'll be able to walk through this pretty quickly. One more thing about that. When you are at a distance and you don't have all the information, again, you want to be very careful. When I was at Southeast in Montgomery, when I got there, they had just discovered that a man who had been a member there for 15 years was in his fifth marriage. He had told them it was his second marriage, but it wasn't. It was his fifth marriage. Now, this was a man who had preached and who had taught in their pulpit and had preached the truth on marriage, divorce, and remarriage, incidentally. And so it wasn't something he avoided. So by all rights, I mean, there was no reason why they would think this would possibly be his fifth marriage. And the way it was exposed is a fellow who had known him some 40 years ago had come in and said, who is that with you? And he said, well, that's my wife. And, well, what happened to this one? Well, that was a name nobody had heard. What do you mean, that one? We're not familiar with that wife. And so there was a trip to the courthouse, and you saw how many marriages he had, and it sort of blew up. The fellow who had come in and exposed all of that because he had known him 40 years before relentlessly bashed that congregation for having not gone and found that information. Now they said, what reason did we have to doubt? The congregation he came from told us that everything was fine. He told us everything was fine. He preached the truth. All the information we had said he was just fine. We didn't have your information. And so this fellow made a judgment against that group based on information they didn't have. And he assumed their responsibility where there, I don't believe, was responsibility for them to go do a full and thorough, go to the courthouse and check their marriages. I presume we don't, we do due diligence. And then we trust. Another situation, and I just want to give you a few of these because I think they're very important. Another situation, there was a man in Birmingham who was preaching there, who I knew pretty well, I know his sons very well. He was accused of sexual misconduct at the local school. And he vehemently denied it. He'd been a teacher for over 30 years, had a stellar record, preacher of the gospel. And even the girl's own family did not believe her. And so I came into the building one day and there were some ladies talking about him, about this preacher. And well, you know what the newspaper's saying? And I about lost it. I said, we've known this man for decades and one accusation comes along and you're done with him. And they said, oh, I know. We were just saying, well, you're just gossiping is what you're doing. The elders at that church stood by him and supported him throughout that. His sons did. And he turned out he was guilty. And at first, even after he pled guilty, he continued to deny and said, I'm just pleading guilty so I don't have to serve a greater sentence. His sons went to plead his case before the district attorney and said, please do not ruin my father's life. And the district attorney said, I'm not ruining anything. And he opened up the folder and said, here's the evidence. And then to go confront their father about that. And so that didn't turn out well. Somebody might say to me, well, I guess you would judge that differently now. I would not go back and do a single thing differently. I would still support any brother in this congregation who I have no reason to doubt if somebody made an accusation against you. I would. And so we don't need to start supplying information and become cynical and become merciless in our judgment just because we've been burned by being merciful. Think God's been burned by being merciful? You know, it doesn't turn out well for God in a great many of his merciful judgments. And he knows all the information. And so we want to continue to exercise this mercy and continue to recognize when we don't have all the information and exercise mercy when we do not. Well, very quickly then, I think we can even show mercy when we are making judgments. Mercy is an attitude. It is the compassion that we feel. In fact, it is a word that is translated compassion in several different places. In Matthew chapter 12 and verse 7, it says, I desire compassion and not sacrifice. Mercy, some of your translations will say there. In Luke chapter 10 and in verse 33, you have the parable of the Good Samaritan. And in the parable of the Good Samaritan, it says that he looked with compassion there in verse 33. But then at the end of the parable, question is asked, who was his neighbor? And the lawyer responds, the one who showed mercy. So you see there's an interchangeableness of the compassion. There's an interchangeableness of that attitude that looks and sees with compassion, even in the midst of judgment, perhaps. It can be shown in judgment as we see from passages like Ezekiel chapter 18 and verse 32, where God is talking about people who are unrighteous, and he says, but do you think I take any joy in their death? No. No, God has compassion. Even when there's death, God looks with mercy. I believe that's what we see in Matthew chapter 23 and verse 37, where Jesus is in an act. He is going through an act that, as some have suggested, reveals the judgment and wrath of God. That's what the death on the cross is. And the death is bringing judgment on those who reject him. And yet, what is it but a tremendous act of mercy? And so he cries out, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing. You see that right there? They do not know what they're doing? That's merciful language. That's compassionate language. We use that language sometimes, don't we? Just didn't even know what he was doing. Does that mean there's no responsibility there? No. Does that mean that we say, well, he doesn't have to suffer, he doesn't have to be punished? No. But we just recognize something there. We recognize something they don't have that they need. I offended somebody several years ago. I was talking about Tiger Woods when he fell from grace so much in the public eye. And I said, I pity this man. I said, pity him? Why? I said, here's a man who has everything a person might dream up. If you just were to make a list, let me think of all the things. He has all of them. He's literally married to a supermodel. It's not enough, is it? I got pity for that. That is. Now you say, so you don't feel bad for his wife. Well, I have pity for her too. In fact, I have more pity for her. But there is a sadness in looking at a situation like that, a pitifulness in looking at a situation like that. And I think people might look in this scenario. What do you mean they don't know what they're doing? They're not reasoning through this. They're not coming to the cross and saying, we want to kill the Son of God. No, they reject that he's the Son of God. Should they know what they're doing? Yes. Are they responsible? Yes. And yet there's still compassion. There's still mercy. They're still looking at these people who he knows are going to lose their souls many of them still will. They will not all be saved on the day of Pentecost. He knows it. But he still loves them. He still has mercy and compassion on them. I think that's what we see in Acts chapter 7. As you look through Acts chapter 7 and you see the sermon that Stephen is preaching, it's almost incongruous for him to say at the end of all this, please don't lay this to their charge. You just did lay it to their charge. You just concluded your sermon by calling them a stiff-necked generation. You just told them what terrible people they are, and then you say don't lay it to their charge? Doesn't mean he doesn't love them. See, at the very same time, I tell somebody that they're lost. The whole reason I'm telling them is because I love them. Is because there's mercy. Is because there is compassion. And so you do see that compassion. Paul in Romans chapter 9, he's going through. You talk about excoriating. You talk about judgment. Start in Acts chapter 2, or Romans rather, chapter 2, and go through chapter 8. And you see everything that he says to the Jews. But he opens up chapter 9 by saying, I am telling you the truth. I am not lying. If it would help, I would go to hell on your behalf. I'd be lost so that you could be saved. You talk about compassion. You talk about mercy. Now, he can't do that, but he would. If that would help, if that would do anything here, he would do it. And I think that's the position God's in. I'd do whatever I could. And he has. He's gone to whatever extent that he can go, even in the midst of judgment, to try to help us avoid that ultimate judgment. But I think also within the midst of judgment, there are other aspects of mercy that we can show beyond the attitude. We can give time. That's what's happening in Joel chapter 2. After all the judgments that have been rendered, he says there in Joel chapter 2, beginning in verse 12, yet even now, declares the Lord, return to me. Return to me, he says, with weeping and mourning. He says, rend your hearts and not your garments. And so then Joel comes in, he says, now return to the Lord your God. And he says, because he is, well, one of the things he says, he's full of compassion. He's merciful. Because he's still giving you time. After all this, he's still giving you time. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 5, as we begin reading there about the church at Ephesus, and you go through and there's these judgments that are being made. There's these condemnations that are being made. And he says, straighten up, because I will come. Not yet, but it's going to happen. I will come and I'll remove your candlestick if things don't change. And so we do that. We give warnings. And we don't just come down immediately, but say, please, please come back. And we give that time. And that time may vary. We can be gentle and kind. Over in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and in verse 14, we see the distinctions of the ways that we might approach different ones, and where they're at kind of changes how we approach them. Over in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and in verse 14, 1 Thessalonians 5 verse 14, we urge you, brethren, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with everyone. My grandfather wrote an article a while back about three women who are not assembling as they ought to. They're forsaking the assembly. One of those women's a new convert. She just hasn't quite got a hold of understanding what it means to be committed and be there every Sunday. She's learning, and she's doing better all the time. One of them, she does know, she's been a Christian for a long time, but her husband is abusive, and every time she walks out the door, he's abusive in his language and sometimes even physically. And so she has a hard time being there all the time. The third one, she's been a Christian a long time, she knows, but she just doesn't like to be here on Sundays. In fact, she likes to be at the beach on Sundays. And he says, now we got the same problem. They don't come as they ought to. But we got three very different people and three very different ways that we need to approach them. One of them, she's weak. And she needs to be taught more. One of them, she's faint-hearted. We need to lift her up, encourage her. And one of them, she just knows better and she needs to be admonished. And so it's going to change how we approach, and our mercy should adjust depending on who that person is. Jude verse 22 and verse 22 and verse 23 talks about going to the one and you snatch one out of the fire. The other you restore with gentleness. And so that approach is going to change. We also consider the abilities. Matthew chapter 25 and verse 14 through 30 is just one place we might go with the parable of the talents. And we look and we see how the master comes in and his expectations change depending on who he's talking to. And you say, oh, so God has different rules for different people. Depends on what you mean by that, but God certainly judges individuals for themselves. Each person stands on their own. And depending on who you are and where you come from, to the one more has been given, more will be required. Teachers will be given a stricter judgment. Here, five-talent people will be expected to be five-talent returns. Two-talent people will be expected to bring two-talent returns. And so, yes. And so as we deal with people, we don't expect everybody to be at the same level. And that is mercy. Even while we're telling somebody that maybe they need to do better, there's a form of judgment. But that judgment can be brought with mercy while we recognize who they are and where they're at in that growth from being babes to being mature Christians or somewhere in between. And so all of that needs to be brought to the table even when we're exercising judgment. I'll say this finally. When we're talking about how much information we have or, you know, looking at the person and figuring out where they are, I do believe that as we look at the pattern of the New Testament, if there's a situation and you go, I just am not sure. Can I suggest to you we have enough information that would tell us to err on the side of mercy? You don't go, I'm not sure, therefore I'm going to draw the conclusion that you're going to hell. No, I'm not sure, therefore I'm not going to make a sure conclusion. I'm not going to draw a sure conclusion. I'm not going to press forward with that judgment. Even if I'm not sure, you want to be confident. You want to be able to say, the lawgiver says. And rest on his judgment. And if his judgment's unclear to us, then we don't supply ours in its place. And I think that will help us a whole lot. It's a tremendous balance to hold here. Are we judging without knowledge, without information? If we are, then we're judging without mercy. God's judgment will be perfect. And one of the things that he will know is how we have judged our fellow man. And if we have judged without mercy, as James chapter 2 says, then he'll be merciless to us. Don't we want God to think the best of what we think and say and do? Yes. Don't we want him to give the best possible connotation to that? Yes. And unless there is something here that suggests otherwise, we want him to exercise that mercy towards us. And our attitude will affect that. I will say this though, don't suppose that you can play on the mercy of God like Israel of old did. They leaned on it and leaned on it and expected it and took advantage of it and despised it really ultimately. And if you sit there and you think I can do whatever I want to and somehow I can hope that God's mercy will still be there for me, no, you see, there's where the judgment is that God has said, oh, I'll tell you what I'll do. You don't have to wonder. You don't have to guess and think, well, maybe. No, he said, you don't follow me, then there will be no mercy. I want to show you mercy, but you've got to follow in with this pattern. You've got to become a Christian and you've got to follow after God if you want to receive that mercy. And so if you're in danger of standing before the judgment seat of Christ and being judged by that condemned, well, then you can have access to that mercy this morning by becoming a child of God. And if we can help you in any way to do that, won't you come forward?